Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
What's it really like to be a songwriter? And who better to talk about that with than Paul Zolo. He is America's premier writer about songwriters. Two fat books. Songwriters on Songwriting and More Songwriters on Songwriting. Total page count, 1,400. In which he's interviewed everybody from Paul Simons to Paul Williams, Ringo Starr to Sia. He doesn't just write about it. He's got two CDs performing his own songs, including the album Orange Avenue, which includes a duet with Art Garfunkel. He's also co-written songs with everybody from the late Steve Allen to Dan Byrne on his newest album, Paul Zolo. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Are you there?
Hello, Marty. Very happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad. You know, your book clearly outlines the passion that people have for songwriting. Mm-hmm. They feel that the song is... I'm going to read this quote from your book. It says, "The song is a true wonder to behold. The entire world seamlessly fusing so many disparate components. Melody, harmony, groove, finger-picked guitar, drummed, rhymed verse, romance, and more. All those delicious ingredients wed together into an organic whole, this swift passage of time, a universe in under 3 minutes. And one can freely enter and lose myself within," end quote. Now, if I read your book, and I was inspired by those 50 success stories that you, all these successful songwriters, and I say, "Paul, it would be really cool for me to make my living as a songwriter," what would you say to me?
Well, I would say it's not an easy way to make a living. If you're looking to make a normal living, looking to make money, maybe not the wisest path to take. However, if you have a calling, if you have a gift, if you love songs and songwriting more than anything, then I would say go for it. You might not be a success in the world. You might not make any money, but there's few more satisfying or magical pursuits. And I would say if that's truly in you and you're inspired by songwriting and the potential of the thing, you should embrace it and honor that part of you and go for it.
You implicitly said the magic word. Your first thing you said was, if you have the gift, or you said the talent, how does one assess that ethereal thing?
That's a beautiful question, and that's probably the hardest challenge for a beginning songwriter. It's something I've just come to realize after studying it so many years and doing it myself, that not everyone has a knack for it. And no matter how much wisdom you share, and the whole purpose of my books was to share wisdom from the great people who have truly done it so many times.
Right.
Unless you actually have a knack, a certain talent, I don't know if it can be developed. You can learn how to be maybe a good songwriter, but to be a great songwriter where songs almost come through you and you know how to craft them and you can control them, that's a rare talent I've learned that's unique to certain people who are just great at it and can't necessarily even explain why. And so for these people, like Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen or Paul Simon, all of them said to me, it's a calling. It's not a job. Even Dylan said to me, mine has never been so professional, it's been confessional. So I think it comes to an understanding that this is something we're driven to do, like any artists are driven to do their unique art. And if you're not really driven to do it, perhaps seek a simpler, less complex, crazy path in life.
Is it a way to get an assessment of whether you have the gift or even something close to it, the potential for the gift, is to listen to a few of the songs and read the lyrics of the songs of a few of the people in your genre that you admire and then say, do I at least have the potential to get close to this, or is that not a good idea?
Well, there's a lot of ways to determine that. I mean, even when you say your genre, a lot of songwriters who are starting out aren't even focused to that extent that they're aware that they're writing in a certain genre, or they're not restrained by that thought, and they're writing maybe in many styles, like rock and roll and folk and a country, and that's perfectly okay. Great songwriters can write in every genre. But that determination, like, are you good enough? I would say no, don't do that. That's detrimental, because no one is going to be that good at the beginning. And except for very rare examples who are just geniuses from the very start. But generally, every songwriter I spoke to, from Bob Dylan to to Lieber and Stoller, to whoever, they wrote bad songs. Carole King, they wrote bad songs for years before they really understood how to do it, because there's so many aspects and dimensions to writing a song that it's very rare to master it right away. So not wise to write your first songs and then compare them to the greatest people who have been writing songs forever. And besides that, it is a subjective determination. There might be songs you write that maybe people won't think are even in that level, but they might love more for many reasons. So it's a real subjective thing, and there's no normal way to truly measure it.
Sure is. You know, you mentioned Leonard Cohen, and one of the things he said in your book is, if I knew where the good songs came from, I'd go there more often. And then when you asked Paul Simon about the key to his success, he said he was really serious. He said, it's luck. You know, I went recently to Berkeley Rep. Berkeley Repertory Theater is the local kind of prestigious theater here. Mm-hmm. And they did this one-man show about Irving Berlin, and this guy, the songs were, you know, they did a bunch of the songs. They were so damn puerile. Like, in your Easter bonnet, with all the frills upon it, you'll be the grandest lady in the Easter. And then he did, like, Blue Skies. Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies. Give me a break. This is Irving F. Berlin. How, you know, that's, I mean, I wouldn't let a sixth, I would give the sixth grader a B on those songs. Right, and well, this is Irving Berlin. What's the deal?
Well, keep in mind, Irving Berlin was writing his songs at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a different era for popular songs. In that age, this was long before the Beatles, long before Bob Dylan, James Taylor, confessional poetic songwriting. In that age, it was the age of melody, and generally lyrics were considered almost transportation for the melody. And let's face it, those songs you just mentioned, those are standards. They have lasted.
I know.
And it might be because those lyrics to us, coming from our generation and beyond, seem soporific and shallow. Mm-hmm. But that was at the time they were in. Keep in mind, the Beatles, their first song was called I Want to Hold Your Hand,
right,
we heard anyway. They weren't writing Strawberry Fields. But Irving Berlin was writing quite remarkable melodies. And also, you mentioned Easter Bonnet. He was a Jewish songwriter. And some people said the great Jewish genius, because he could write all those great Christian songs. He took blood out of Easter and made it Easter Parade. He took Christ out of Christmas and made it about snow. So in some ways, he was an extremely brilliant, savvy songwriter, working in very limited music education and writing melodies that have lasted. I really think his achievement is those melodies. If you pay attention just to the words, especially in modern context, I understand they seem shallow and cliché, but that's where modern songwriting came from. Paul Simon, Bob Dylan, they studied those songs.
What about, I mean, you think about, I mean, you mentioned Strawberry Fields, so what... You know, it's certainly a song embracing drug culture. You know, what makes that a greater song than I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is one could intellectualize and say, argumentative, you know, arguably, this is about the basic connection between human beings. Why is Strawberry Fields better than I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Well, it isn't necessarily objectively better. To me, I like it more. But I don't want to put down I Want to Hold Your Hand. That's a brilliant song. I remember distinctly in 1964 when it came on the radio. It was thrilling. The record, the sound of their voices, and musically, I know Marty, you're a musician.
Yeah.
It's in G, and then the bridge goes to D minor, which is actually the minor five, which is maybe too technical, but an unusual thing to do in rock and roll. That's like something Cole Porter or Irving Berlin would do, an old-fashioned, sophisticated chord change. So musically, they were already extremely sophisticated, kind of breaking simple musical rules. But I found that their lyrics grew more deep and more complex and dimensional. And to me, that was perfect for the time, because we were entering the later 60s, and there was mind expansion going on. And I was just a kid. I wasn't doing drugs, but I understood the shift in the culture spiritually. Intellectually, there was a major shift going on, and it was reflected in that music. And sure, we all know that they were smoking pot and then doing other drugs, which expanded their consciousness, but they were actively expanding the content and potential of the popular song. So to write Strawberry Fields Forever, Strawberry Fields, a real place in Liverpool, an orphanage, but using that as a takeoff point for almost a psychedelic, nostalgic trip. It was really not done in any other way. And for me, just the title and that music and then the amazing track, of course, that they created, is so magical. It's maybe my favorite Beatles track. But again, what makes a song great? It's up to everyone. It's a subjective determination. Leonard Cohen made that real point. He said there might be songs we find insignificant that someone loves because they're taking a woman into their arms with that song and courting them. And human activity dignifies songs, not songs dignify human activity.
You know, because this show needs to focus on work, I want to bring us back a little bit to the work issue. Now, you know, you mentioned Bob Dylan a couple of times. Now, clearly, you know, I was a musician of the era right before Bob Dylan became really popular. And everything was about brilliant chord changes and tonality and gorgeous voices and, you know, Barbara Streisand-type singing. And then you get Bob Dylan. And I was shaken to my foundations that, you know, that his lyrics were so resonant with the zeitgeist of the era that it transcended his unbelievably terrible singing voice. So riff a bit about, if I'm trying to choose a career, I mean, and I'm trying to cite, you know, should I be a musician, a songwriter, etc.? And, what, you know, the most basic thing you would think is, can I sing? And yet Bob Dylan couldn't sing worth squat. And Paul Simon is not, you know, there are singers in the best singing competitions in Napa Valley who sing a hell of a lot better than Paul Simon does. Tell me about choosing a career and how important singing voice is, or musicianship.
Well, that's a great and important question. And you're not alone in feeling that not only was Dylan a bad singer, but that he simply could not sing at all.
Right, he can't.
It's not an opinion I subscribe to in any way. He clearly can sing. He's been singing for decades. And it's not a traditional singing voice. But keep in mind, he wasn't growing out of only the Barbara Streisand Sinatra tradition, though clearly Sinatra means a lot to him. He's recording Sinatra songs right now in the same studio over at Capitol. But Dylan was coming from Woody Guthrie and folk singers and Lead Belly and the blues, Lightning Hopkins, and these people weren't singing like Sinatra. It was more organic and earthy, and it was about an authentic human expression. And so when Dylan decided to start writing the kinds of songs he did, he before the Beatles, stretched the content of popular song. He made longer songs, but made them more poetic and abstract, and just used potentials of song lyrics we hadn't heard before, but always matched with good melodies. So, personally, I love the way Bob Dylan sings, but there's times he's off tune. I mean, I understand why a lot of people I respect don't think he can sing at all.
Right.
I get that. But I think that the ultimate impact of it was to show that this isn't about writing contrived songs like Easter Parade, which you would think is contrived,
right,
or some other artist. This is me performing my own work. And in that way, it's a change from like the Elvis Sinatra school, where you're singing someone else's words and music, to doing your own, which becomes an existential performance and an existential art. This is what I created, and I'm bringing it to the world. And by knowing as a songwriter that your song is going to get recorded no matter what, even if it has strange lyrics or it's called Subterranean Homesick Blues, that changed popular songwriting because you could write suddenly about anything. And that's what influenced the Beatles. John Lennon said he never would have written Help until he heard Dylan and realized, well, I can write about my own life. So I think the impact of Dylan, in disregarding the vocals, which a lot of people don't like, is his impact on modern songwriting and all songwriters following him was just immense and profound.
It is a profound change. It really goes well beyond the music to the whole issue of virtuosity. To what extent is virtuosity critical? To what extent are we hierarchical? One is better than the other. Are all voices, and the more different the better, fine. You know, this is what deconstruction was all about. This is all about tearing down the hierarchy. Do you think that it's over-intellectualized, or is it or does that represent the truth and change in the zeitgeist that occurred in the 60s?
I think it does reflect it fairly accurately. I mean, there was never a lack of great vocalists who sing in a traditional, beautiful way. To this day, we get someone like Adele, who is a traditionally wonderful vocalist, and there's no denying that brings a lot of joy to people. But it doesn't matter as much a great vocalist without a great song. And things shifted after Dylan, that every great singer felt they needed to write their own material, which was not really the case. That some people are just wonderfully gifted virtuoso singers and aren't gifted at songwriting, and vice versa. And we hear a lot of great songwriters who aren't great singers, you know, a lot of country people, Towns Van Zandt, but there's so many, John Prine, but write genius songs. But we also hear some great, great vocalists who write songs that, to me, aren't even worth recording. So Dylan's impact has been negative and positive. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there's no question that some people are just born with amazing pipes. Like David Bowie was an amazing songwriter, but a remarkable singer. And there's many like that who are, you know, you think of Paul McCartney and John Lennon. They were blessed with amazing voices. And there's no denying that. And would the Beatles have ever been the same if they sang like Dylan? I don't think that's possible. You know, for their music, it was great. So there's no denying virtuoso great talent with both singing and with the songwriting.
What if I argued that the Beatles singing is nowhere near, nor Art Garfunkel, compared to, let's take some modern people, like Idina Menzel or Jennifer Holliday or, Heather Headley. Do you know those names? I mean, those
to me... I don't know Heather. I know the others.
Yeah, Heather Headley was, she won the Tony Award for Aida, and then she's gone. Uh-huh. She's an amazing, amazing singer.
Yeah.
You know, when I say these are kind of musical theater superstars,
yeah.
Does that, in your visceral gut, does that move you less, for example, than these, in my judgment, less virtuosic people like David Bowie or the Beatles or whatever?
Well, I don't consider Bowie or Beatles not virtuosic. They don't sing like musical theater style. But I've never been a fan of that kind of singing, though I understand it has a place, and especially if you're on stage and you're trying to get a lyric across, or if you're in a Sondheim show, you got to sing those things right, and I appreciate that kind of singing. But when it comes to the music I listen to,
mm-hmm.
I like something more visceral, more soulful,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's more connected, I think, to the material, that most of the people I love are singing their own material. I think Bowie is a tremendous singer, a huge, you know, power, almost operatic. And McCartney, too, is a pretty versatile singer. You know, he can sing in every style and is an amazing harmony singer. And in popular music, as you know well, to sing good harmony really matters. And there are certain people mm-hmm. like McCartney or Garfunkel, I think, do it better than just about anyone.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We are talking about what it's really like to be a songwriter. And now I think we need to take things out of the abstract, dude. And
okay.
I think we need to play an MP3 of one of your songs that you both, you know, you walk the talk. You wrote it, you performed it, and you did it as a duet with your favorite accompanying singer, Art Garfunkel.
Yeah.
Let's listen, and I want to hear your if you were the critic writing for a major magazine today and you were critiquing the song, what would you say, great, bad, and analytical about that song? Go.
Okay.
Hold on, we're gonna play it.
Prayed a patron saint, his father at the factory. He dreams of playing in the major leagues. It is 1933. His eyes are Virgin Mary blue. He walks along a rattle hole. The snow is falling all around. He's pitching to DiMaggio. Being in this world, being in this world, being in this world. Father walked the earth all along the railroad track to sharpen knives from town to town. Whetstone wheels strapped to his back, walnuts in his wrinkled hands, fish lures in his crumpled hat. Pockets all full of sunflower seeds. He was happy with no more than that. to be. Being in this world. Being in this world. Being in this world. Everybody in their own time. Everybody in their own space. It takes dreams and prayers and wine to run this human race. His mother had a rosary.
Okay, that was Paul Zolo off his album Orange Avenue. And why don't you tell us what, you're the critic now, you're a critic critiquing your own, you're writing this review, what would you say about the song?
Well, I would admit that I'm, I wouldn't admit it, but I am biased.
Right. Of course.
I would say that is quite an interesting song. It's folky, there's no drums, but I really like the narrative lyric, and I think the harmonies by Mr. Garfunkel are just beautiful. I like that they change all the time. So many harmonies you hear, they just repeat the same thing every chorus. And that guy's voice singing, maybe it's certainly not a virtuoso kind of voice, but he gets the lyric across. But I'll admit, I can't ever, you know, subjectively critique my own stuff.
You know what?
I love it. I think it's just tremendous.
You know, the line in that that I think encapsulates it all, I find is real interesting, is it takes dreams, prayers, and wine to run this human race.
Yeah.
Comment on that.
Well, that's in the bridge, and anyone
right.
that knows about bridges or songwriting, or what the Beatles used to call the middle eight, that's the section where you go to a third part of the song you haven't heard yet, and you can kind of step away from the song, and sometimes bridges will give you an overview, and the whole song is specific about what it is that being in this world is about, and how we get through, which is not always easy, human existence. And one way is that the character's mother's very religious, praying to patron saints. She's got a rosary. That's one way. Other people, like his dad especially, turn to drink, to wine, and prayers and drink. And so there are various ways we can escape what can be the hardships of humankind. That's what that meant.
Okay, now we're going to give you a chance to not be biased.
Okay.
I have written a total, grand total, drum roll, of one song that I wrote and play with lyrics. I want you to be a tough-ass critic, okay?
Really?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
We're
going to
put it on now.
Okay.
Should I get high? Should I have sex? Strive for A's or live with C's? Go to college, how far from home? Buy a label, or do JC? Far away from parents' eyes, party down, or study up. Follow my bliss, choose art, not biz. Be real cool, or be straight up. God, give me the answers. Or does God live in me? They say the answers do lie within, but where can they be? Where can they be? So I'm a grad and wanna hang, but not fall behind the rest. Take a job or do more school. Opt for balance or be the best. Keep the squeeze or search for more. Go get hitched or cut the chain. Go have kids and keep the wings. Leave the spouse and stay in lane. God, give me the answers. Or does God live in me?
They say the answers lie within, but where can they be? Where can they be? Should I retire? Should I look back? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? God, give me the answers, or does God live in me? They say the answers do lie within, but where can they be? Where can they be?
Okay, there you go.
I like that a lot. That was beautiful. Are you there with me, Marty?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay, well, let me tell you, number one, Marty and I have already discussed this, that we're both members of the tribe, that we're both Jewish, and so many of these people we're discussing are Jewish, and that is an influence on music, and that melody is in G minor, and that's a very Hebraic melody. I mean, it really is right in there with klezmer music, even that key. And that's, to me, beautiful. One of the reasons Jews, for so long, whether or not they're conscious of it, are such expressive songwriters is that they connect with music like that. And that's the first thing that hit me, and I think gets to me mostly about songs, is the melody, the music. No matter what the lyric is, it could be Strawberry Fields. If you don't have an expressive melody, it's not going to move anybody. You know, music really moves the heart. Mm-hmm. The lyrics appeal to your brain in a different way, and also the heart. So I like that, and I like that, I mean, the song is for God, so it's a prayer. It's God, give me the answer. So that's really the essence of songwriting. That's, you know, the heart of why so many people do write songs, to try to get the answers. And it's okay that the song doesn't provide the answers. It's a prayer of yearning for answers, and that's very true to the human condition. So I like that. And I like the song has a lot of it's kind of funny, unique lyrics, and they're specific and detailed. I don't like vague songs that have no nouns or details, something like emotions. You know, you want details, and that was very specific to you. To me, it seemed like it was true to the author. And in my experience, I think a lot of people feel the more specific you are about your own life, the more true you are, the more universal the song is. So I only heard it once, and I thought it was great. Melodically, it's quite sophisticated and beautiful. I'm amazed. Is this the only song you've ever written?
Yep, I've written one instrumental thing, but it's the only song with lyrics I've written, yeah. Anyway, okay. What would you say sucks about it?
I wouldn't say anything sucks. I wouldn't say that. I don't even do bad reviews ever, and I'm a music critic.
That's interesting.
But, you know, what I would say honestly is that would not be an easy song in today's culture. That's closer to previous generations, where you write a great expressive lyric and a beautiful melody. Unless you had a great singer like an Adele, that she co-writes her own songs, to sing it as a ballad. It's a ballad, and it, you know, in terms of the market, it's one thing. But I don't generally look at things by the market. I just look at it. Is it a great song? 10 years from now, will that still be great? And I would say yes. And to me, that matters more than anything.
That's a very interesting thing. You never write a bad review. You know, I've written some reviews. I'm critical by nature, and it feels like there's almost a cosmic obligation we have in whatever we do, whether we're a boss in supervising people or writing reviews or whatever, to give feedback, both in the case of reviews. So, you know, there's so much entertainment out there. Mm-hmm. If they're to trust me at all,
sure,
they have to view me as a curator, as somebody who says, you know, here's one you should pass on.
Yes,
here is
I
one
totally
you should go to.
That.
So why wouldn't and you? Why would you only write positive reviews?
I understand from a journalistic point of view, it's not even ethical what I do.
Right.
But I'm a musician first, and I have written bad reviews in the past and have regretted putting anything into print forever about a fellow musician, especially as my feelings about the music shifts. So what I do is, if I don't like something or I don't think it's worth attention, I don't write about it at all. But I don't need to denigrate it in any way. But that doesn't mean that everything what I write about, I'm phony. I celebrate stuff I think is truly great. And occasionally I'm, you know, I will point out weaknesses, but I don't really think it's that helpful for me to go on and on about why I personally find something bad. I think it's more important, I go overboard to be hyperbolic and to praise greatness, because there's so many great people doing so much work, and without press they get no attention. So to me, that's where I focus more, praising and celebrating and explaining why the great stuff is deserving of attention.
You know, moving beyond the, you know, the realm of music, there's so much generalizability there. You know, here in the Bay Area, there's a tremendous sense that cops overreact. And people who write, journalists who would write puff pieces about cops would be excoriated. They'd lose their genitalia. So it's almost, in fact, they'd be, they're more encouraged to be critical of them because the truth is be, or, you know, today we don't have a truth. The various truths, certainly the truth that is critical of the fuzz, which, to speak of an earlier generation, the cops, is worthy of doing.
Absolutely.
So, well, if it's, if you say absolutely in writing about cops, why isn't it also true about musicians?
Because we're writing about art that is entirely, in my mind, divorced from writing about the world we're living in, our society, our laws, our politicians. If you're, and I've done journalistic writing. If you're writing news reporting, if you're writing editorials about current events or dynamics in city politics or government politics, any of it, you need objective reporting. You can't only write positive stuff. I don't think that applies to music writing. And I don't think people necessarily... I don't write for a newspaper... I write for a magazine. Many of my reviews are online. So I don't think people are looking to me for the objective truth on what's good or bad. But they'll see, oh, Zola says this is good for these reasons. So I think it's valuable for that. But in no way do I mean that news reporting should ever do that in any way. Especially nowadays, it's really important that we hold to the truth, because the truth is getting so mixed up, and intentionally so. They're messing with the truth, knowing most people, especially in America, have limited attention spans because they're looking at their phones and everything else, and they can easily distort the truth. So I think that kind of objective journalistic reporting is more important than ever, and I can see so many of these writers are galvanized and empowered by the modern times.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a career counselor, and the real, you know, it drives me crazy when I hear, for example, I see the New York Times headline is, unemployment rate 4.6%. When in reality, there are so many people not covered in that government-perpetrated unemployment rate who are underemployed, unemployed, have given up. You know, fake news comes from across the spectrum, from the right wing to the New York Times. And I really do think you're right, that what we really need is a sense of this almost sacred, because, you know, you sound like you're more of a believing type person, an almost sacred obligation to present the full range of responsibly held views. Anyway, I want to give you, I want to give out the phone number, actually. I want to take one or two calls if you, my dear listeners, are inclined. If you have a question or a comment about the career, I want to stay on the career thing because that's what this show's mandate is, on the career of songwriting. This dude, Paul Zolo, who's written 700 pages on a book of interviewing 50 songwriters called Songwriters and Songwriting. He then wrote 700 more pages where he's interviewed everybody from Paul Simon to Ringo Starr to Sia to Bob Dylan to Sheldon Harnick, the guy who did Darn Fiddler on the Roof. So... if you have a question or a comment about the career of songwriting, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, my special guest, Paul Zolo, really nice guy. No, really, we talked off the air, we emailed a bunch off the air. This guy is a sweetheart. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls to come in, I want to give you a softball last question. I like being this kind of Talmudic, ask the hard question kind of guy. But let me end with a softball.
Talmudic with me, please.
Yeah, well, no, you did fine. We've already played the Mishnah bag, whatever that is, back and forth. We got calls, and let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What is your question or comment for Paul Zolo?
Hi, I've heard that in the past few years, Nashville has lost a lot of songwriters because they can't make a living, and it's always been a difficult business, but I wonder if the guests could comment on how much more difficult it has gotten in the days of streaming and artists demanding credit for work that they haven't done, and et cetera.
Yeah, that's an important question. That's one of the hardest things about the music business and the songwriting life right now, is that the business we knew and the way it was supported by law was helpful to songwriters, and that's no longer the case. In past times, you could go to publishers in New York or California and bring your songs directly can't really do that anymore. But you can in Nashville, you can still go to producers, and in Nashville there is still a community that's more receptive to new songwriters. But it's a different kind of community. They're mostly people writing together, and it's just a different world. If you're writing songs nowadays, you can't look to the industry necessarily to immediately support it.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for the call. You know, that brings up a whole issue. You know, again, the kind of anti-capitalist screw the label movement has actually unfortunately screwed the musicians too. There's so much pirating of music that where the musician who finally manages to write something and make a few dollars with a label, there's so much pirated that he or she gets crappy. You know, doesn't get much in the way of royalties. What are your feelings about illegal download, you know, pirating of MP3s?
Well, I think it's really it's a huge problem. It's a profound problem, and I think most people, civilians, don't understand why. But songs are not free. The, you know, authors of songs, like books, like TV shows, deserve compensation. And certain places like ASCAP and BMI were set up a long time ago. So songwriters get paid when their song is played on the radio. Every time you get paid. Not a huge amount, but if you get played a lot, it adds up.
Right.
Nowadays, I get a lot of play on internet radio constantly, and I don't get a penny.
Exactly.
For that. And it's not the same. If you're a farmer and you're selling apples, no one expects you to give them a free apple. And a song matters just as much as an apple. So there's many different ways songwriters aren't getting compensated, and from every angle. And really, technology took off before the industry had any way of dealing with it. So now they're going to Congress, and Paul Williams at ASCAP, and certain people are champions for trying to make sure that the system becomes fair again. Because right now, the traditional way songwriters were making a living has just been destroyed completely. And I know a lot of great songwriters who aren't even participating anymore for that very reason.
And isn't Spotify and Pandora making it worse? Because I imagine that they give their singers really almost nothing. Essentially, you could make a hell of a lot more money flipping burgers at McDonald's, or am I incorrect about that?
Well, I'm not an expert, but my understanding is for any of them, and same thing with YouTube that does compensate, it requires a huge amount of hits or, views.
Millions, right.
Before you get anything. So
right.
Unless you're like my friend Dave Stewart from Eurythmics, they get millions, and that adds up. But if you're a typical songwriter, even if you get 10,000 hits, that's 10,000 people. It might add up to nothing.
Right.
So Pandora, all of them, they're revising and they're negotiating, and I frankly don't know which is more fair right now, but I'm hopeful within the next years we'll come up with some solution that makes it equitable for everyone.
Yeah, let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My very nice guest, Paul Zolo, the author of Songwriters, on songwriting, and more songwriters on songwriting. They're really great. The guy really knows how to write. He doesn't, when he writes music, it's one thing, but he also, as I read in the beginning of the segment, he writes very beautifully as well. Good text. So, okay, what's your question? It's your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for Paul? Are you there?
Yeah. Is it me?
It is.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a good show. Thank you. My father wrote a song that was very big in the 1950s and 60s, and he sold the rights. And I guess once you sell the rights, that's it, huh?
Well, sometimes you get a royalty, depending on the kind of. What was the song?
Great Balls of Fire.
Oh, of course, Jerry Lee Lewis. Right, I can hear the piano glissando as we speak. Okay. Right. Am I right, Paul, that most contracts do have a royalty agreement, but it may expire?
Let me ask you a question, please. Am I not correct that Jerry Lee Lewis got complete credit for writing that?
Well, he sang it, but my father wrote the lyrics, and another person wrote the music part.
Okay, so your father did get official credit for writing the song?
Yeah, yeah. And then what I understand, he passed away last year at age 90. But what I understand is that something about selling the rights for a while and then you get it back or something?
Well, generally, you can sell your publishing rights, which is half of the total rights, but not the authorship. You should still be getting half of anything it's generating, and that's a standard. So that should be generating some big royalties. So your father might have been with ASCAP, but maybe BMI, I'm not sure. You simply have to check with them, and And that's okay. their job, to answer this very question, because they want to help you. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. the funds are coming in. They collect, too, so it's in their best interest. Mm-hmm. I would guess it is ASCAP that he's with. But either one, ASCAP or BMI, there's only two of them. You got to call either one.
Yeah, you know,
that's good information. And I asked him, how did he come up with those lyrics? And he said, when he was a kid, his grandmother in South Carolina would say, if anything happened, well, goodness gracious, great balls of fire.
Listen, you know, my engineer here also is a lawyer, and she wisely said, you really should be consulting a copyright attorney. So that may be, if you can dig up the contract, if there was any agreement, if you could show that of anything to a copyright attorney. Paul, do you agree?
Okay, is your father Jack Hammer?
Yeah.
Okay, so it was written with Otis Blackwell and Jack Hammer. Otis, a famous songwriter.
Yeah.
Sure, that might be BMI. Very easy. Before you get a lawyer, just find out what's going on and get the information. If there is a case, you definitely got to get a good lawyer, and there's ones that do it great. But, you know, that's a very huge song. That's a standard.
Absolutely.
Is there any way to contact you later to see if you could recommend a lawyer for me?
Absolutely. You can find Paul Zolo on Facebook. I'd be happy to help you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Great. Sure. Thanks for the call. That's great. Great Balls of Fire, boy. That's back for way back. Okay. Now, as I promised, I wanted to give you a softball question. Let's say there was one thing that you want to tell my listeners that you haven't told them about the career of songwriting. What would you want to tell them?
I'd want to tell them that though they might hear it's a hard thing to do because it's a hard way to make a living or crazy or people get strung out on drugs or whatever, it's really one of the most exciting things there is. If you're a songwriter, getting to write a song and getting to live inside of music is pure joy. And that's the one constant. I've talked to so many songwriters from the old generation, Sammy Kahn, who wrote for Sinatra, through Sia, like you said. And very few of them can deny the fact that when you write a song and you got a great one, it's just so thrilling. And that the great songs, as almost all of them said, almost seem to come like gifts. I mean, you work on them, you craft them. But great songwriters are really tapping into another place. And as Stevie Wonder said, when you're doing that, you're expressing the real truth of what's going on in our lives now. So it's a really great and exciting and important thing to do.
So haven't you really made the argument there for songwriting being the world's worst career and the world's best hobby?
Well, I never would consider it. I mean, if you're a serious songwriter, you don't want to think of it as a hobby. It's a calling. You know, you might not make a penny for it, but as Van Dyke Parks said in my first book, songwriting, the writing of a song is a triumph of the human spirit, because the world isn't telling you to write songs. It's not an easy way to make a money. If you want to make money, there's so many more direct paths to take, but it's such a beautiful and exciting thing to do. So yeah, I would tend to think it's maybe one of the worst careers, but also one of the most exciting.
Well, you are one of the more exciting guests I've had, and I just felt a certain just kinship with you just as a human being.
Thank you, Barney. It's great to talk to you. I really appreciate getting to be here.
Yeah, it was awesome. Paul, and his book, again, there too, it really is worth reading if you care about songwriting at all, whether you're a songwriter or just an appreciator of it. He really has these great interviews. He, you know, of 50 of these people from Pete Seeger's wife, or is it not Pete Seeger? Who was it? It was Marjorie Guthrie. That's right, on Woody Guthrie. His wife to Paul Anka, to Herbie Hancock in the jazz domain, Stephen Stills, Paul Simon, Ringo Starr, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, Paul Williams, the great orchestrator. Great book, and it's amazing, you know, how much work goes into something like that, and you can, for the cost of a large pizza, get that book at your side 24/7. Paul Zolo, thanks again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty, very much.
Take care. Bye. Okay, we've got about 15 minutes, and now I want to turn my attention to you, you know, to your practical career problem. If you've got one, I can usually help you take at least a baby step forward. I call them workovers, with no pummeling involved usually, but certainly whether you're 16 or 76, whatever your work-related problem, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, for-profit or non-profit, all that's required is that you're concerned. If you got a work concern, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 4 Workover. This is the time to call when the phones are not lighted up, all the lines. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay. While we're waiting for all the calls are coming right in, so I'm just going to tap dance here for a little bit. I really do love songwriting. He was so lyrical in the way in which he described it, and it's true that the act of creation, whether it's poetry or novels or screenplays or magic tricks or fine art or photography or songwriting. It is the human urge to create, to give pleasure to themselves or to others in the moment, or even we fantasize about leaving a legacy. I'm just putting out my, I'm making a list of my bibliography. I have written 8 books, 3,000 articles, 4 plays, 4 screenplays, about 70 short stories, a lot of piano playing, a lot of YouTube videos, and there is this inexorable desire to share what we create. So certainly that is to be encouraged, whether it be as a career or as an avocation. Anyway, I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, for a workover, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So my name is Connie.
Hi, Connie.
And I'm calling in to work for state government, but I'm wondering how it is to deal with a boss that is abusive, bullying.
Mm.
And there's been complaints, and there's been some change, but I'm just wondering because that the bullying comes out at times, and, you know, it's quite scary. So any advice?
I'll be sure, of course. Let me ask some questions. Stay with me, because I'm going to ask you some questions here. So sometimes bullying is intrinsic to the person. He or she is just a mean person who's sadistic or has mental illness problems, but sometimes it's only the symptom. He or she is being a bully sometimes, for example, because she is brilliant and she has some really great ideas and she gets frustrated because she's so passionate about the calling, working for the state. She believes that the government is great and wants to do good things for people, and she can't stand lazy workers, and so he or she is really tough. Is this boss's bullying, do you think, intrinsic to this person just being mean or mentally ill, or is it a symptom of something deeper?
No, symptom of something deeper. Truly passionate, which is great. But, you know, on the other hand, sometimes you're the target of, you know, anger and, you know, and it's intimidating.
Right. So it is simplistic of me, but it is my honest heartfelt statement that when someone's, we call it bullying, that's the term du jour to dismiss them. But if we call them instead passionate to excess, and I say that the wisest thing, if he or she is a, you know, is really smart and is well-intentioned, then the wise person who is working for them separates the message from the messenger. And it's easy to be defensive and hate the person and want him gone or whatever. But the wise person would be to not react to him or her. Is it a man? I keep going him or her. I'm doing this by gender thing. Is it a man or a woman?
A woman.
It's a woman. Okay. If this woman, I would separate the message from the messenger. And if she's yelling and screaming, "You lazy, stupid idiot, how could you do that?" I would probably walk out. And immediately, of course, your visceral reaction is, of course, is rejection of that person and negative. But I would take deep breaths, to use the Bay Area term, I would meditate, be mindful, I would whatever, and I would ask, is there wisdom in that message?
I mean, there are times, I mean, that's one thing. I mean, just cutting people down in groups, you know.
Right. Well, again, that can be, again, it could be a sign of psychopathy, it could be a sign of meanness. The question is, if that cutting down, if the goddess would look down and say, you know, that boss is right in cutting that person because he or she is lazy, stupid, malevolent, unethical, whatever. And even if the tone is terrible in the way in which it's dispensed, even if it embarrasses that person in front of others, the wise person, to the best extent she could, would go into her soul privately and deep, like I said, deep breaths, be mindful, all the rest of it, and say, shouldn't I take something from that and see if I can grow from that, if I can learn from that? And if not, then the really or even harder question is to say, this is a person who has unusually high standards. Maybe I am not quite up to this person's standards. Maybe the cosmically just thing for me to do would be to see if I could move to a workplace that doesn't have such high expectations, where me, with my reasonable best efforts, could meet them. What are your thoughts about any of that?
Totally right on.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
I just want to say that I loved your song.
Oh, thank you very much. It really is. I've read a lot about people's great works. Not that mine was a great work, but they often just flow immediately. Some of the great concertos, the great novels, the great songs, sometimes are written in 20 minutes. I think it was Paul Simon. I was reading this book. The book again was Songwriters on Songwriting, and then more Songwriters on Songwriting by Paul Zolo. A number of them, some of their best songs were written in an hour. And I find that some of my best articles were not those or books, not especially articles, but do not pour forth, or do not require this sweat-inducing struggle for years. They can come out in an hour because they somehow, in my brain, become coherent. They flow naturally. So, yes, those are my thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. Okay, I do want to, I think we have time for one more call, so I'll give out the phone number again. If you've got a work problem of any sort, I can usually help. And this is the time to call. I do have lines available, so this would be the time to call. Price is certainly right, as I like to say, zero zippo nada. The phone number for a work over on Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And came across my desk just yesterday. This comes from CareerCast, and they identified something called Jobs, the top CareerCast 2017 jobs rated report. And here are, and these ratings were based on a combination of the job market, how fulfilling they are. See, some of this is subjective, which I think is good. Here were examples of some of their best jobs for 2017 and worst. I'll just check them right off. These are the top 10, and then the worst. They did 200 careers. These were the top 10 rated. Statistician, medical services manager, operations research analyst, information security analyst, data scientist, tenured university professor. There's very few that are tenured these days. Mathematician, software engineer, occupational therapist, and speech pathologist. What those top 10 seem to have in common is something that I've experienced lately. When I started out as a career coach 29 years ago, I felt like the soft skills were as important as the technical skills. If you were a good writer, if you were a good collaborator, you're a good communicator, if you were able to listen very well to people and you remained calm under pressure and were well organized, that was as important, in many cases, more important than having tech chops. But over the last 10 years, it seems to me that for most decent paying jobs, not the volunteer terror $10 an hour, $15 an hour things, it is indeed the hard skills. So we go over these top 10 again that show both growth in growth outlook to 2024 and the high annual median salary and sense of reward. They almost all of them, require real technical chops. Number one was statistician. Number two is medical services manager. This is somebody who's probably in hospital administration or managing an urgent care clinic. Operations research analyst, very computer-centric. It's about running businesses very efficient in terms of logistics, very computer-centric. Information security analyst, clearly not soft skill-centric. Data scientist, that's, you know, analyzing big data sets. That's completely technical. University professors, a tenured one, doesn't get a tenured professorship unless you have deep knowledge. Mathematician, software engineer. Occupational therapist is a little softer, but there's still, you got to take a lot of biology. Speech pathologist is also going to take a lot of biology. We're in an era where the specific technical skills are darn important. I don't like that. I'm a communicating kind of guy by nature. I wish we lived in a world where, yeah, those soft skills were valued. But it appears, if I'm to be honest with you, my dear listeners, they're not. Now let's look at the bottom 10. This is from number 200 down to 191. This is with the lowest salary and the worst job outlook going forward. Number 200, the worst, newspaper reporter. And again, that's because so many people are willing to write for nothing. The Huffington Post pays its writers zero. The Huffington Post is one of the biggest advocates for workers. If you see most of their articles, they're all worker-oriented, and yet most of their writers write for zero. The hypocrisy is breathtaking. And you have 200 professions. A newspaper reporter is now last, and yet the universities continue to offer journalism programs, taking their $100,000 or $200,000 for a four-year degree in journalism, assuming you even graduate in 4 years, and yet it's the lowest ranking in terms of salary and employment possibilities, because so many reporters write for nothing. I've written, as I've said, 20 essays for Time magazine. Total pay, and in the prestigious ideas section, total pay, zero. This radio program, 28 years or whatever I'm doing this show on KLW, total pay, zero. Because we all have a desire to create, to make a difference, to share. Back to the top 10 list of bad careers according to the CareerCast in terms of job outlook and salary. Broadcaster, number 199. Number 198, logger. 197, enlisted military personnel. 196, pest control worker. 195, another broadcast one, disc jockey. Advertising salesperson. Yeah, I could see that not being very rewarding. Firefighter. A lot of death rate and injury rate from all those fires. Retail salesperson. I could see why that ultimately feels unethical. I just read again, Death of a Salesman. Amazing. Maybe the best anti-capitalist play in history. And taxi driver. Now, that one I liked. Anyway, those were CareerCast top 10 and bottom 10 professions in terms of median salary, growth potential, and intrinsic reward. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my previous guest, Paul Zolo. Again, his book, excellent book, Songwriters on Songwriting and More Songwriters on Songwriting. My thanks always to my board operator, Joanne Marr. Put together all that music well and a smooth and seamless. Thank you, Joanne, as always. And, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And Ty Cobb was one of baseball's greatest stars, but he had a terrible personal reputation. I'm going to talk with Charles Learson. He is Ty Cobb's biographer on that career element dealing with a bad reputation. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.